All right, good. Open up to Genesis chapter 1 with me. So the book of Genesis is broken down generally into... No, it's gone. Mark, I'm just taking this as a sign, okay? Just taking it as a sign. Yeah. So JDP... Yeah. I still got the phone going. All right. I'll yell out. All right, open up to Genesis chapter 1. Now, as I mentioned before, pivotal key text for us. And not only is Genesis 1 through 11, and especially chapter 1 and 2, not only is it a pivotal key text, but it's a text that is assaulted, oftentimes. It's a text that's highly assaulted by those who don't hold to the authority of the word, because they don't want to hold to God's authority. So if the Bible sets up God as the authority, as the creator, well, they don't want to hold to God as the authority, so therefore they try to dismantle what we have in early Genesis. So I love this text, Genesis 1 through 11, because it's, in a sense, we're kind of jumping into a new world. We're jumping into a world that is so far removed from our 21st century mindset. So far removed from the 21st century world that we live in, that it's just fascinating to study for me. Now, Genesis 1 through 11, we want to be very careful about how we interpret. We want to interpret at face value. What is the text saying? And is the text speaking clearly to us? And we want to interpret it at face value. Okay, so our hermeneutic and the way in which we interpret the scripture is very important for us in Genesis 1 through 11. You can get all kinds of crazy interpretive ideas from Genesis 1 through 11 because people will approach it with a wrong hermeneutic. They'll approach it with a wrong view of how to study the scripture. And it doesn't mean that it's a secret to uncover the meaning in Genesis 1 through 11. It just means that we need to read it at face value. We need to take the text at face value. Okay, it's not tricky. You don't have to be a Hebrew expert in order to understand Genesis 1 through 11. You just have to read it carefully, and you have to read it at face value. The way that Genesis is broken down, you have Genesis 1 through 11. This is, in a sense, kind of pre-Abraham or leading us up to Abraham. You have Genesis 12 through 22. Speaking in particular about Abraham. You have the patriarchs and the patriarchal period. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph starts in chapter 37. So Genesis 37 through 50 is speaking about Joseph. Genesis 1 through 11 then is, in a sense, it's a little, I don't want to say frustrating, but I wish, I'm not Moses, I didn't write Genesis 1 through 11, but I really wish that there were more chapters put into Genesis 1 through 11. If there's like a certain allotment of chapters, like the Bible had to be so many chapters, I always joke with my students, couldn't we like maybe take a chapter or two from, I don't know, Leviticus? And have another chapter talking to us about how God created the world and the process by which he creates the world. I would love and I am excited to understand more about how God created the world. And when you ask, what are your questions you're going to ask when you get to heaven? I want to know how God created the world. What a fascinating portion of scripture. What a fascinating opportunity for us just in this short portion of scripture that we have, 31 verses in chapter 1, 25 verses in chapter 2, talking about the creation itself. So we want to study this very carefully. We have 4 weeks that we're going to take in Genesis 1 through 11. 4 weeks that we're going to look at these portions. And the way that I've broken that down is today we're going to look at Genesis 1 and 2. We're going to look at pre-fall, okay, before the fall. Next week, we're going to take a look at Genesis 3, 4, and 5. This is the fall itself, which we're going to have to spend some considerable time on. We've got a talking snake, and we've got a woman who's answering this talking snake's questions. And we're saying, how is there a talking snake? Why is, when the snake comes and talks to Eve, why doesn't she say, why are you talking to me? She doesn't say that. She answers the snake's questions. And what does the snake do? What are the curses that come? What's the result of the fall? We're going to see that. Paul even picks that up in Romans. Paul very importantly picks that up in Romans and talks about the creation, which is groaning, right? Waiting for its redemption as well. It's not just our redemption as Christians, but the redemption of all of creation. So we'll take a look at 3, 4, and 5. After that, we're going to take a look at 6, 7, 8, and we'll delve into some of 9 as well. Okay, 6, 7, 8, and 9, talking about the flood. We're not talking a local flood. I think we have a little hint of the flood in the portion that we're going to study today. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. We're going to talk about the flood. And then after that, we're going to talk about the nations. Okay, that includes Tower of Babel, but the table of nations, the genealogies that we have in chapter 10, very, very important to set up what are the nations and what does that look like today? We don't have the Amalekites claiming to be Amalekites anymore. We don't have Kaphtor claiming to be the Kaphtorites anymore. So what does the table of nations look like for us today? How do we to understand that? So we'll take a look at that in our last week. We've got a lot to get through in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. So let's dive in to Genesis 1 and 2. Anytime that I have my seminary students start in a particular passage, I always ask them, what's the context? What came before? What's leading up to the passage that you are teaching in? It's only in Genesis 1:1 that we don't ask that question. Okay? Any time after Genesis 1:1, we ask the question, what came before? What was written before? Who was writing it? How does the context have bearing upon what was written before? Here we do not have that. And this is what's so fascinating about Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There is no statement of what came before. There is no explanation about, oh, before this, the angels were created. Or before this, Satan fell. Or before this, none of that exists. It's in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And we'll see that there is a great deal in Genesis 1 and 2 that is not explained to us. It's not explained to us. There's a central focus, and we'll see that. We're going to start really, really broad. And we're going to start with all of creation, creation of the universe. We're going to focus down on the earth, and we're going to focus down on the animals being created, and we're going to focus down on man being created. We're going to focus down on the Eden. We're going to focus on the garden, which is within Eden. And we're going to get to a really pivotal point by the time we get to chapter 3 of one conversation in one garden in all of the universe that brings about a fall. Okay, so we have this large structure to start us out with, and we have a narrowing that occurs over the next few chapters. So, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Verse 2, the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters. I want you to pay a special attention to those two words, formless and void, in verse 2. And I want to leave, I'm going to leave time at the end for questions as well. So, I have all kinds of questions. So write down questions as they come up, and I'll leave time at the end for questions. But I want to give an idea to you, a hypothesis to you about the organization of creation. Okay, so formless and void, there's two separate ideas there. Formless is there's no shape to it. Void is it's void of life. Okay, void of life. we have 6 days in which things are created. Okay, I would argue that days 1 through 3 is trying to fix or rectify the formless problem. And days 4, 5, and 6 are fixing or rectifying the void problem. So you can think of days 1, 2, and 3 as days in which spaces are created. Days 4, 5, and 6 are days in which those spaces are filled with life. Okay? And it seems as though there's some kind of correspondence to the days as well. So day 1 is the creation of light and darkness. Light in particular. Darkness is not something to be created. Okay, so the creation of light. Day 4 is the creation of sun, moon, and stars, which are given authority to produce that light or to govern that light. Govern the day, govern the night. Okay, so there's a correspondence. Day 1, day 4. Day 2, you have an expanse which is created. Okay, a separation between waters. It says waters above and the waters below. And on day 5, you have created the fish and the birds, which inhabit that expanse, inhabit the waters, and inhabit the expanse in between, the air, okay, birds. On day 3, you have the creation of dry land and vegetation. And on day 6, you have the creation of the land animals and man. Okay, so it seems as though there's some kind of correspondence between days 1, 2, and 3, creating the spaces, and days 4, 5, and 6, creating the animals or the things which inhabit those spaces. Now, I want you to take a look in particular at verse 3. And I want to point out a pattern that we're going to see within this creation. A pattern that we're going to see. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And I like how this is translated. Let there be light. This is something exactly that I bring out with my students when I teach this. I ask, what is the statement that God makes? Let there be light. What is that statement? Okay, the way that it's set up is let there be light. Like, let's go to lunch. Okay, if I was to say to you, let's go to lunch, I'm expressing a desire. I'm expressing a wish or a hope. Okay, I tell my students, let's get an A on this exam, guys. Okay, a hope, a wish, a desire. When we as humans express a wish or a desire, we have no idea if it's going to happen or not. I say, let's go to lunch. And maybe we end up going to lunch, maybe we don't. Maybe something comes in and intervenes, maybe it doesn't. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. It's us expressing a wish or a desire. Not sure if it's going to happen or not. But the way that it's set up in the text, God says, let there be light. By him saying, let there be light, it turns into reality. So God says a wish. God says a command, if you will. Okay, I can give someone a command. I don't know if they're going to carry it out or not. I don't know if they're going to do it or not. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. My 2-year-old, lately, I'm not sure. I don't know. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes we need correction, sometimes not. I give a command, maybe it's carried out, maybe it's not. God gives a command, it turns into reality. Okay, so there's a very important play when it says there, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And every time something is created, it does the same thing. It follows the same pattern. God says, let this be, and then it is. Okay, let this be, and then it is. Verse 4, God saw the light was good. God saw the light was good. Now, if you were here for my last, the session that I did last week on Ecclesiastes, I touched on this a little bit. I think in Ecclesiastes, Solomon is saying, I want to get back to that good. I want to get back to that good. I'm trying to get there, okay? And he's saying the world is broken. How do we get back to that good? What is the good that's being talked about here? God said, let there be light. There was light. God saw the light was good. What's good about the light? doesn't mean morally good. Light is not morally good or morally bad. It's light. It just is what it is. So what's good about the light? What's good about the light is it does exactly what God created it to do. Light always does exactly what God created it to do. There has never been a point in all of human history where light did not do exactly what God created it to do. So God sees that the light is good. That statement is saying, look, this did what I created it to do. The purpose for which I created it to do, it accomplishes it. As we go through those days of creation, it's going to say again, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. It's always doing what it was created to do. Okay, the fish multiply in the sea. The birds fly in the air. The vegetation sprouts up from the ground. And it was good, and it was good, and it was good. Chapter 3, and it was cursed. Okay, we'll talk about that more next week. There's this play between being good, doing what you were created to do, and being cursed. God says, now the ground is cursed. Now the ground does not do what it was created to do. There's a twisting, there's a fracturing of it. You put in seeds, maybe they come up, maybe they don't. I grew up on a big farm in Colorado. Farming is like gambling. You spend all your money, you put in the seeds, maybe it rains, maybe it doesn't. Maybe the seeds come up, maybe they don't. It's kind of like gambling. My dad always joked about that. So there's a fracturing that takes place after the fall that we'll talk about next week. But I want you to see that repetition of good. Good, 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 good. What's good about it? It's doing exactly what God created it to do. It's fulfilling the purpose for which God created it to do. The second thing I want you to see, or the third thing, first of all, God says, let this happen, and it becomes. Okay? He says, let this happen, it turns into that. It exists now. Right after that, it says that this thing now is good. There's a recognition. It's doing what God created it to do. Right after that, God names it. God names it. Verse 5, God called the light day. The darkness he called night. You say, well, why is it necessary to give it a name? Why is it important to give it a name? God is not only demonstrating that it's good and it fulfills the function for which he created it to do, but God is saying, I am the one who has authority over this. I name this. I tell you what it is. I communicate what it is. I communicate its identity, and I'm the one who determines what it is and how it functions. I give it its name. He'll delegate that authority to the man, right, when he names the animals. One last thing that I want you to notice, and again, I'll open it for questions at the end, because there's so many things to talk about in the first five verses. But one other thing that I want to, one idea that I want to posit to you is the separation of light from darkness. Picture with me, if you will, the Spirit of God is hovering over the face of the waters. God says, let there be light. When God says, let there be light, I would argue that the entirety of the universe is illuminated. There is no place where there is darkness in the universe. Let there be light. Everywhere there is light. It is only after that point that God separates the light from the darkness. There's now a separation between the light and the darkness. Okay, so darkness is not a thing. It's just the absence of light. It's not a created thing. In the same way, in 2, God says, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters. Well, a separation between waters is not a created thing. It's just a separation. It's just distance between two things. Okay, but God does not create the darkness. God creates the light. The entirety of the universe is illuminated, and then God separates between the light and the darkness. Let's move to day two. God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate waters from the waters." So God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning a second day. I asked my students in class a simple question. Say there's waters below. We're taking those as being the sea. There's an expanse between waters. So there's waters below, there's an expanse, and then there's waters above. And I asked my students, where are the waters which are above? What are they? Right?
The
atmosphere. Leo?
Clouds.
Okay. There's several different ideas about the expanse. What it is. How big is the expanse? I want you to keep that idea. Well, actually, let me give you the two ideas. Okay? And then I'll keep that idea in your mind, because the text or a verse later on, I think, is going to help clarify this for us. How many have heard of the canopy theory? How many have heard of canopy theory? Okay. I go back and forth on canopy theory. Canopy theory is a theory that says that there was a water, like an ocean, in the sky surrounding the earth, okay, before the flood. When the flood comes, God basically collapses that water back down on the earth. There's water which comes up from underneath the earth. Okay, so there's a collapsing that happens. Water which is above, water which is below the ground, coming up, that's the flood. Okay, so it's a theory about a canopy which surrounded the entire earth. I go back and forth on that. Okay, I go back and forth on it. The other question would be something like atmosphere, right? Where there is water in the atmosphere, okay, which is above clouds, that kind of a thing. The other option, or the other hypothesis, if you will, is that whatever's at the edge of our solar system, or at the edge of our universe, excuse me, is water. Okay? Keep that in the back of your mind. We'll come back to it when we get to day four. Okay, so there's evening and there's morning a second day. So on that second day, the only thing that's created is something which is not is a physical thing. It's not a physical thing. It's just an expanse. God says, we have water. I'm going to separate between the water. I'm going to have water above, and I'm going to have water below. All right, day three, God creates the dry land. He gathered the waters. He called them seas. God saw that it was good. Now, notice in particular in verse 9, then God said, let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place. One place. Okay? Waters are gathered into one place. Dry land appears, which means that the dry land is one place. Okay, so the dry land is one place. The waters are one place. There's a separation between the two, which is why I would see that in the creation, we don't have multiple continents. We have one land mass, one water mass. Okay, let the waters be gathered into one place. Let the dry land appear. How big were those waters? How big was the ocean at that time? I don't know. How big was the land mass? Not sure. Okay, but dry land appears. Waters are gathered into one place. Notice again in 10 that he names it. He calls the dry land earth. The gathering of the waters he calls seas. God saw that it was good. It's following this same pattern. It's doing exactly what God created it to do. It's good. It's good. It's good. At the very end, we'll get it's very good. The earth sprouts vegetation, plants yielding seed, fruit trees on the earth bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them. It was so. There's this interesting description given about how is it going to reproduce. We're going to see according to its kind.
So the vegetation produces according to its kind. The trees produce according to their kind. The creatures produce according to their kind. Talking about the species that we have. There was evening and there was morning, a third day. So again, days 1, 2, and 3, I'm seeing this as the solution, the fix to the formless question. I have spaces which are created. I have light and darkness created, or light created. I have an expanse created, a place. I have dry land created, a place. Now days 4, 5, and 6 are going to be a filling of that. Okay, it's going to be a filling of those to rectify or fix the void problem. Life is now going into these spaces. Verse 14, and talking about the fourth day, there's a lot of description that's given about the fourth day. And on the fourth day in particular, it says that God gave the sun, moon, and stars authority to rule the day and the night. You can see that in verse 18, to separate the light from the darkness. So God, for the first time, is delegating authority to something, in this case, the sun, the moon, and stars, delegating authority to something to do something on his behalf, okay, which is to rule over the day and over the night. I'm moving quickly through this because my time is going, but I want you to look at verse 14 in particular. Verse 14, then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. When it says the expanse of the heavens, it's the same word that's used for that expanse between the waters. Okay, so whatever that expanse is, there's water above the expanse and water below the expanse. Whatever that expanse is, it's putting the sun, moon, and stars in that expanse. Which is why I, at this point, don't hold the canopy theory. Again, I go back and forth on it. Canopy theory makes so much sense when you come to the flood. But that verse in particular, it's putting the sun, moon, and stars in that expanse. So I'm not at this point seeing the expanse just as being only our atmosphere here, because the sun, moon, and stars are within that expanse. So let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and then let them be for signs, for seasons, for days, and for years. There's four words which are given. Let them be for these things. We understand the days, right? I get the days, okay? Sun's up, daytime. Moon's up, nighttime. I get the seasons. We're in January because of where the earth tilted, rotation, et cetera, okay? We get that. Days and years. Seasons, absolutely. Rain's coming, right? We don't have any, like, seasons in LA, okay? But the season which is about to come upon us is rain. Rain, rain, rain. Praise the Lord. And we have rainy season and we have super dry season. Those are the two seasons that we've got in LA, where I grew up in Colorado. Seasons. All right, so we get the days, years, seasons, signs. Sun, moon, and stars are for signs. And that's different than the other three words. So what do you mean for signs? What are you talking about? For signs. I just preached a text in Cornerstone on the Magi. And the Magi come to Jesus and they say, hey, we saw his star in the east. And you say, how would you know what his star is? What are you looking for in the star? How is the star moving? How does it come and rest over a place where Jesus is? And I don't know that I gave a great deal of help to Cornerstone. I basically just asked a bunch of questions as I was teaching. But it says that these sun, moon, and stars are for signs, seasons, days, and years. So what's the signs? There's something about them being created for the purpose of signs. And this is taken so many different ways. I could just throw out a title of a book to you that was done in the last, let's just say, decade that has to do with blood moons, okay? There's all different kinds of interpretations about the signs. What are the signs? Okay, again, I want us to be careful about reading the text and see that it's there. It says that sun, moon, and stars are for signs. It doesn't give further explanation. It doesn't say it's for these signs in particular. These are the signs that you're looking for. It just says they're for signs. I'm not really an astronomer. I'm not an astrologer. Let me clarify that. I'm not an astronomer either, so I'm not often looking up into the night sky. But there's something about sun, moon, and stars being for signs. Signs of what? I think we could point in particular to something like prophecy given about the sun being darkened, moon being turned into blood, or looking like blood. We can look at some of those things, prophecies in which it's taking sun, moon, and stars and is saying here in particular is a sign for you. We can take that at face value. Okay, a third of the stars fell from the heavens in Revelation. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know what that is. I just take it at face value. I'm not sure how do a third of the stars fall from the sky? But it's a sign nonetheless. Okay, so on that day four, okay, there's God's giving them authority to separate the light from the darkness. They're for signs, for seasons, for days, and for years. He places them into the expanse. I want you to look at verse 16. This is where we really start to narrow down our focus. We, because of various cultural reasons or whatnot, don't often elevate man as we should. We elevate man in the wrong ways in our culture and not in the right ways. In the text that we have in Genesis 1 and 2, we have this focus. Here's the universe. Here's the earth. Here's man. It just narrows down in focus. Man created in God's image, given authority. Look at the end of, verse 16. So God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. I love this phrase. And also the stars. That's it. Oh, by the way, I almost forgot to mention, but oh, by the way, he created the stars. Yeah, that galaxy that you look up and you see, okay, the galaxies that are a dot in the sky that I can't even fathom how far away that is. Oh, by the way, he created those two. I love that. I love that statement. God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. Oh man, I'm going to run out of time so quickly here. Okay, let's move on. Let's move on to day five. Day five, God creates in the midst of the waters living creatures. He creates the fish. He creates the birds. Look at verse 21. It gives a couple of different categories of things that dwell in the water that are created. He created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves. The great sea monsters. What fits into that category? I'm not exactly sure. I'm not a huge fan of open water. Okay, I'm not a big fan of that. My wife loves to go surfing. There's something about being on a surfboard, and I'm like, I just can't see what's beneath me. The water's murky here. At any point, you know, I'm gone. I don't like that. I don't like that feeling. God creates the great sea monsters. What fits in that category? Whatever you can imagine, I'm guessing. He created every winged bird after its kind. He saw that it was good. The sea monsters to the little sparrow does exactly what God created it to do. It is what God created it to be. God saw that it was good. God blessed them. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the waters and the seas. So verse 22 is this first instance where we have this command given be fruitful, multiply, and fill. Contrast that verse 22, if you look into day 6 at verse 28. Verse 28, God blessed them. God said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. So that's to man. We have be fruitful, multiply, fill, and subdue, and have dominion as well. Okay, to the birds, to the fish, be fruitful, multiply, fill. To the animals, be fruitful, multiply, fill. To man, be fruitful, multiply, fill, have dominion over. Okay, subdue it, have dominion over. I'm sorry, we have to go fast. I take a whole semester. At the beginning of the semester, I tell my students, guys, we're in Genesis 1 through 11. We'll be lucky if we get to the flood. Okay, we'll be really lucky if we get to the flood over the semester. There's so much to talk about. But I promised Mark that I would get all the way, you know, to the end. So I'm skipping over these things. Again, I'll leave some time at the end for questions. Let's move on to day 6. Okay, let the earth bring forth, verse 24, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle, creeping things, beasts of the earth. There's a few categories that are given. Okay, those things which creep around on the earth, think insects, those things which are of the field, those things which have breath in their nostrils, he creates them after their kind. God saw that it was good, the end of verse 25. Verse 26 and 27, so important for us to understand man. A simple statement, verse 26, a simple statement changes our entire worldview about how we are to understand the importance of man, the nature of man. And not very much explanation is given. It says God created man in his own image. And even at the beginning of 26, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. The only us, our in reference there is Trinity. There is not another reason to take the us, our as being anything other than Trinity. You'll hear all kinds of arguments. This is like the heavenly council, right? But we're not created in the image of angels. So it doesn't fit. It's just us, our Trinity. We'll have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, cattle, everything that's on the earth, everything that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Male and female, both in the image of God. Mankind, humankind, created in the image of God. And that simple little statement changes our whole anthropology. It changes our whole understanding of who man is and what man is supposed to be, what man is ontologically. It's not just that man is separated because man is supposed to subdue the earth. Man is not just separated out because man is supposed to have dominion. Man is separated out and made unique because man is created in the image of God. So we spend all kinds of time talking about what is that image. Two words are used. In our image and our likeness. Two words are used. In our image and in our likeness. Is that speaking about two different things? Likeness, in translated likeness, I think is a good translation of it. To look like something. Do we look like God? Is that what the idea is? Image? What is that? Several places in the rest of Scripture will help us to understand what that means. You take a look at a Psalm 19. You take a look at the text that we were looking at before in Ecclesiastes last week. Okay, what is man? What is his nature? You take a look at a text like the Noahic Covenant, even coming up in a little bit. Man, if you shed man's blood, by man, your blood will be shed, should be shed. Why? Because created in the image of God. Okay? Because it's created, man is created in the image of God. So it doesn't go into a huge amount of explanation. He just says he created him in his image, in his likeness. And you've got to work throughout the whole text of Scripture to understand what are all the implications of that. God has set eternity in the heart of man, Ecclesiastes chapter 3. He set eternity in the heart of man. That's very different than animals. Does that include the image of God in man? Man is able to use language and think in terms of metaphor and in language rules in order to communicate. Is that the image of God in man? Is that a part and parcel of it? What exactly is encompassed in that? There's a great deal. My time goes so quickly. All right. Next to last thing that I'll mention in chapter 1. Look at verse 29. God said, "Behold, I have given to you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of the earth, and every tree which has the fruit of the tree yielding seed, it shall be food for you. To every beast of the earth and every bird of the sky and everything that creeps on the earth which has life, I have given every green plant for food." Animals were not eating each other before the fall. They ate plants. A lion eating plants is completely separated and distinct from our 21st century context. I was talking about the animals, you know, being on a surfboard and the animals that's coming up to eat me, okay? That's because we're post-fall. Animals eat each other. And this is a repercussion of the fall. The fact that we have carnivores is a repercussion of the fall. We'll talk about God giving animals to man that for food when we come to the flood, after the flood. Don't throw away your steaks just yet, okay? All right, verse 31. God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. It was very good. There was evening and there was morning the sixth day. Okay, it was very good. It did exactly what God created it to do. There was nothing out of place. There was nothing that wasn't functioning as it was supposed to. Every molecule, every animal, everything within creation was doing exactly what God had created it to do. Chapter 2, heavens and the earth were completed and all their host, right? Everything which inhabits them. So the heavens and the earth, the spaces were created and all their host, everything which lives within them, which inhabits them. On the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from his work which he had done. Notice the emphasis, work which he had done. Okay, even if we just start in verse 2, notice all the words for work and completion. On the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done. He rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it because on it he rested from all his work, which he had created in making it. Okay, there's 8 references there to just saying God did it. God did it. God's the creator. He rests on the seventh day and he sanctifies it. So many questions about that. Sanctifies the seventh day. Again, the text says it, but doesn't give explanation to it. What are we to, I'll pose a question to you. What are we to understand about what we're supposed to do because God rested on the seventh day? Now, when you have the Mosaic covenant established, there is the Sabbath designated. Okay, to such an effect that someone who is under the Mosaic covenant, if they work on the seventh day, they're to be stoned. They're to be killed. Okay, within the Mosaic covenant. Is that taken exactly from here? Or is this a general statement to say God set it apart? The idea of God sanctifying it means that God made it unique. Okay, so I have 6 days of creation. On the seventh day, God says I sanctified it because I rested. I stopped all my work and I rested on that seventh day. And so I'm making it unique. Amongst all of the 7 days, I'm making that one unique. I'm setting it apart, sanctifying it. Well, how much can we extrapolate from that for us today? Okay, if we're living in the Mosaic Covenant, at the time of the Mosaic Covenant, when the Sabbath is all of the laws are given for the Sabbath, you do not work on the Sabbath. Okay, but how much can we, as New Testament believers who are not under the Mosaic Covenant, how much do we extrapolate from this start of chapter 2? Okay, you have Sabbatarians, you have all different kinds of views and arguments about how we, as Christians in the church, are to treat the seventh day. Okay, we're not going back to the Mosaic Covenant. We're not obeying the Mosaic Covenant, but how much are we to understand about what we should do on the seventh day because of this section? Okay, as a creation, let's call it a creation ordinance. Okay, what are we to understand about that? I need to give you at least my idea and opinion before I move on. I'm giving like huge, you know, I'm lobbing grenades. I'm just throwing big grenades out there. It's like, here you go, here you go. I don't think that when it says you're free to argue with me, please do. Check this with scripture. God blessed the seventh day and he sanctified it. There's no command that's given there. There's a setting apart. You're to recognize that it's set apart. You're to understand that it's sanctified and set apart. Okay? How much are you supposed to do commands based on that? Well, there are no commands that are given. Are we only to follow in God's footsteps and say, God sanctified it, set it apart, so we should set it apart? And how does that relate to Sunday now? Because the seventh day is Saturday, not Sunday. Okay, so I see in the New Testament a pattern of meeting on Sundays. And I think we should meet on Sundays because of the pattern of the New Testament church. But I go back to this verse, and I don't think that we are given a command here, do not work on the seventh day. I think God sanctifies it, sets it apart, but there's no commands given. Notice the difference between this and the end of chapter 2. If you look at 2:24 and 25, Adam is given his wife. Adam says, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Verse 24, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. That's a command. That's a, it should be this way. Notice the difference between the start of chapter 2 and the end of chapter 2. Okay, in the end of chapter 2, I have a really, really clear creation ordinance. A man shall do this. He shall leave his father and mother. He shall cleave to his wife. The two shall become one flesh. That's this should be the case. Here, I see God sanctifies it. I don't see you shall never work on that day. I don't know. I want to recognize that God sanctifies it. He sets it apart. But how much do I, what do I do in response to that? There's no further explanation that's given in the text. Okay, when we come to the Mosaic Covenant, we have clear laws given about Sabbath, but we're not following the Mosaic Covenant. We're learning from it, but we're not following it. We're not under it. We're not bound to it legally. All right, verse 4, pay special attention to that word or the name, Yahweh God, Yahweh Elohim, depending on your translation that you have. Either it's going to be, you know, capital L-O-R-D, but that's Yahweh. That's the first time that the name Yahweh is used. And it's not only the name Yahweh, but it's the name itself, Yahweh God. Sometimes in the Old Testament, often in the Old Testament, you'll have Yahweh our God or Yahweh the God of our fathers or something like that. This is the name, Yahweh God, okay? Yahweh Elohim. Okay, it's the name used, and it's used
several times in Genesis 2 and Genesis 3.
And then within the Torah, it's never used again except in Exodus chapter 9, I believe verse 30. Okay, it's not used again until Exodus 9:30, which is a really interesting passage of scripture. You look it up and take a look at it. Okay, but the name Yahweh God is used. Why put in Yahweh now? Before, we didn't have Yahweh used. From 1:1 through 2:3, we have Elohim only. Elohim used. Title. Okay? God Almighty. The God. Okay? Capital G. Now we have Yahweh used. So why use Yahweh now? Moses, in his writing of this text, and I believe that Moses wrote all of the Torah, and Moses, in writing this, there's a connection. It's not just God. It's not deism. He set it up and then said, here you go. It's Yahweh now. And we have, in chapter 2, we'll have, in a sense, a second telling of creation. We're going to go back to day 6 in chapter 2. And in chapter 2, there's this further elaboration. There's the I want to understand what's being said. It's the let's take that chapter from Leviticus and give me more explanation about creation. I love chapter 2 because it's going to slow down and it's going to give all of this description about creation, the creation of man in particular. And the focus moves from God Almighty, God as creator, God as sovereign, all-powerful one, to God creating man from the dust, to God putting the man to sleep and taking a rib out of the man and creating the woman out of that rib. It's Yahweh God. It's covenant relationship God. It's we have relationship with this God. It's not just, yeah, he created it, and then, you know, he set it off and said, hey, good luck, creation. You know, have fun till whatever you do, blow yourself up. This is covenant God. He doesn't leave you alone. He creates, he sets it up, he organizes, he orders it, sets it all up, and he says, I am Yahweh God. We have relationship. Notice that name, Yahweh. And notice, as we go through 2 and chapter 3, it's Yahweh God, Yahweh God, Yahweh God, okay? All right. No shrub of the field was yet in the earth. No plant of the field had yet grown up. For Yahweh God had not caused it to rain on the earth. I want to, for the sake of time, I want to set up a picture for you rather than only just reading through the text. Check all of these things, though. No shrub of the field, no plant of the field. Yahweh had not caused it to rain upon the earth. Instead of it raining to bring water, it says that there is a river which comes up out of the ground and it waters the whole surface of the ground. Okay, you have one land mass, you have one water mass. Dry land, seas. And it says that there was water which came up out of the ground and watered the whole surface of the ground. Okay, so if you want to grow your crops, if you want to be a farmer, everybody's a farmer at this point, another fact that my dad loved to point out. If you want to be a farmer, where's the water coming up? Let me go plant my crops over there. It's consistent. It's steady. It's a spring that's coming up. And springs that are coming up to water the whole surface of the ground. God had not caused it to rain upon the earth. We'll come back to that when we get to the flood. I argue that the first time that it rained was when the flood happened. God had not caused it to rain upon the earth. The first time it rains is when it starts to flood. People see water falling from the sky and they say, what is going on? We do that in LA at the beginning of the rain season because we have short memories. But he had not caused it to rain upon the earth yet. I'm going to take 2 minutes and I'm going to just go a little bit more in depth on verse 5. I think that the two mentions of the plants, no shrub of the field and no plant of the field. I think that shrub there is talking about weeds. So it's saying there's no weeds yet in the earth. Okay? The reason why I do that is the Hebrew word that's used here, it's a very particular word. And it's used once, used twice after this. But once it's used in Job in reference to like a desert wasteland. And it says that this plant was in this desert wasteland. The other time that it's used is with Hagar and Ishmael. And remember, Hagar didn't want to watch Ishmael die. She had been cast out by Abraham. She didn't want to see him die. So it says that she put him under this Hebrew word shrub in the desert. They didn't have any water. So she put him under this shrub, tree, bush, whatever that it is, and walked away. He says, I don't want to see my son die. Okay, so every time that this word is used, it's used in mention of desert wasteland, weeds. So when it says that there's no shrub of the field yet in the earth, my argument is, it's not a slam dunk, but my argument is that it means there's no weeds yet. Why are there no weeds? Because we're before the fall. And there's no plant of the field. My argument for that is mean there's no cultivated plants yet. There's all kinds of plants producing, trees producing, but there's no cultivation. There's not a field yet. Why? Because God had not caused it to rain upon the earth. In other words, flood hadn't happened. There's not a flood yet. And there was no man to cultivate the ground. Okay, so there's no man to cultivate the ground. Therefore, there's no cultivated plants and there's no weeds. Okay, so it's setting the scope. It's setting the period in verse 5 and saying, all right, let's go back. Let's go back to that day 6. And we're going to talk more in detail, in depth, about the creation account of man. Okay, so this is before weeds. This is before cultivation of plants, because God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there's no man to cultivate the ground. Instead, a stream rises, we talked about before. God forms man from the dust of the ground, breathes into his nostrils the breath of life. Dust is very, very important in this text. In chapter 3, we're going to see it come up again. Ecclesiastes picks up on it again. Dust. Made from dust, to dust you return. We'll talk about that more next week. The mentions of dust in chapter 3 are extraordinary. Interesting. Verse 8, Yahweh planted a garden in Eden. Okay, Eden is a location. Eden is a place. It's like a province. It doesn't say how it got its name, Eden. Okay, my daughter's name is Eden. I love the name Eden, and I named her because I just love the name. But there is no explanation in this text about where did Eden get its name from. God named it. Doesn't say when he named it or why he named it Eden. Just says he named it, or here's Eden. And it says within the province, within the area, however big that it is, of Eden, God places a garden. God makes a garden within Eden. Okay, so Garden of Eden and Eden are not synonymous. Okay, think about Eden as being California and the Garden of Eden being Los Angeles. Okay, maybe not the best example to use, right? So he plants a garden within Eden toward the east. And we'll talk about east more and more as we go. When the man and the woman, Adam and Eve, are kicked out of the garden, there apparently is only one entrance to the garden. There's only one entrance to the garden, and that entrance faces east, rising sun. Okay, even the Hebrew word just means the rising sun. Okay? There's one entrance to Eden. The man and the woman are kicked out of Eden. The picture is that they go in front of, east of, the entrance of the garden. And they pitch their tent right in front of the entrance. As you have people rebelling, you just have this movement east. Cain starts moving east. You have the population moving east to the plain of Shinar when we come to the Tower of Babel. There's a movement east. Yahweh God causes, verse 9, Yahweh causes every tree which is desirable in appearance and good for food to grow there. The tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What are those trees? I would love more explanation
about what those trees are.
But it just says it like you know what I'm talking about, right? The tree of life. Like, you know what I'm talking about. It was there. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. What is the tree of life? What is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? I think that there's some further explanation given about tree of life when we come into Revelation. When we come into Ezekiel and those prophecies about New Jerusalem and there being a tree whose leaves are for the healing of the nations. This idea of some kind of tree that is actually efficacious to bring about healing, to bring about life. When we see, I hold very much to premillennialism, and I would see the millennium, I would see God ruling from Jerusalem, from his throne in Jerusalem for 1,000 years, and I would see this tree being there. And it says in the millennium that there will be, if someone dies when they're 100, they will thought to be accursed. Well, how do we have lifespans expanding so much? We have a tree of life. So what does that look like? I think we get a little explanation from a Revelation, but still, how is it efficacious? In what way? Adam and Eve ate from the tree of life. Not after the fall, but before the fall. There is no command given to them saying, do not eat from the tree of life before the fall. I would say that they ate from the tree of life before the fall. Now, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, this one is more of an enigma. What is it about the tree that's good and evil, or that it's bringing about good and evil? Is it just the tree of the knowledge of good and evil only because the command is placed upon it? In other words, God says, don't eat from this tree. I'm placing a command on it. I'm separating it out from all the other trees. Is there something that's actually efficacious within the tree itself, like I think the tree of life is? Or is it just that God said, all right, this one, don't eat from this one, right? And that is what makes it the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Is that the case, or is there something actually efficacious about it? I lean more towards the idea that it's just, God said, it's this tree. Don't eat from this one, period. No explanation given. Notice that when man and woman eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they're cast out of the garden, and God says, I don't want them to eat from the tree of life again. He doesn't say, I don't want them to eat from the knowledge of good and evil again, okay? But I don't want them to eat from the tree of life now. All right, starting in verse 10, we have a river going out of Eden. So you have a river in Eden. It goes out, it comes into the garden, and then after the garden, it splits into four separate rivers. Description is given: Pishon, Gihon, Tigris, and Euphrates. And I would love to spend a lot more time talking to you about Bdellium, but I don't know what Bdellium is. It's just in Hebrew, it's just Bdellium. I just transliterated over. I don't know what Bdellium is. I'm not really sure on that one. But notice the description that's given. And why is it important that these four rivers are mentioned? Why is this necessary? This is laying out for us the layout, the scope. But in particular, notice the first two rivers that are mentioned, we can't equate to anything today. The second two rivers that are mentioned, we know of at least rivers that have the same name today, Tigris and Euphrates. Tigris is mentioned and it gives explanation. It says it's the one that went east of Asher. Okay? Asher is something that comes about after the flood. The fourth river is the Euphrates. And there's no explanation given. It's just like, you know what the Euphrates is. You know what it is. That's one of the rivers. Okay, no explanation is given. Where was it? Where did it go? How can we have two rivers before the flood that have the same name as two rivers after the flood? In what way does that happen? Okay, in our mind, the flood destroys up. There's upheaval, completely changes the landscape, changes everything about the face of the earth. But then I have two rivers that are the same after. Are they just renamed that after, or are these, they're not, I mean, they could be the same rivers if they're flowing in the same place that they were before, after the flood. It's good questions to ask of the text. God takes the man, sets him in the garden to cultivate it and keep it, gives him purpose. God commands the man from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat, for in the day you eat it, you will surely die. We'll talk about that next week. It's not good for the man to be alone. I'll make a helper suitable for him. This is going back to image of God and man. Why is it not good for the man to be alone? Because of the way in which he's created. Right? You, Trinity, even. There is perfect relationship and unity within the Trinity. If man is created in the image of God and is created in the image of a triune God, then it's not good for the man to be alone. It's not good for him to be on his own, by himself, alone. I will make a helper suitable for him. God brings the animals to the man. But for Adam, a suitable helper was not found. So God causes him to sleep, takes a rib out of the man, forms the woman out of that rib. Brings the woman into existence. And he brings the woman to the man. And the first words, I just want you to notice the first words. Verse 23. Man hasn't spoken yet in this creation account. No words coming out of his mouth. Man said a poem. And in Hebrew, it's a beautiful poem. This one finally is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called Isha, woman, because this one was taken out of Ish, man. It's a beautifully orchestrated, organized poem. Adam has incredible intelligence. There's not a diminishing of his mind because of sin. There's not a twisting of his mind. This is perfect union, unity with nothing that's fracturing or causing problems. We'll emphasize this next week when we talk about sin. What are sin's effects? The fracturing of an individual, the fracturing of relationships, the fracturing of the good, the fracturing of even the land. Verse 24 and 25 in particular, this emphasis shall leave his father and mother, shall cleave to his wife, shall become one flesh. The man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Nothing to come between them. Nothing hidden. Nothing causing any issues or division in their relationship. And there's a play on that word naked. And it says the serpent was more crafty. Same word that's used between naked and crafty. That'll introduce us next week. How do we have a serpent coming in who is more crafty? Same word that's used. All right. I said I would leave time at the end for questions, and there's 4 minutes left. So I feel like I've accomplished my task. Again, next week, very important to focus in on chapter 3, but 4 and 5 as well. So much to talk about. So we'll talk about 3, 4, and 5 next week. But I want to open it up. Questions? Yes. Yeah.
Genesis 2, the son of Day.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah,
right. So no evening and morning. So there was evening and there was morning the sixth day, right? The very end of chapter 1. And then there's no mention of evening and morning after. It's not as though there wasn't. It's just not mentioned in the text because you wouldn't have to keep track after that point. I think when it says evening and morning, it's defining the days. And it's saying day one. What is a day? Evening and morning. Notice that evening comes first and then morning after. Very important to pay attention to that. But for the seventh day, it starts because the sixth day has ended. Evening and morning, sixth day done. Seventh day starts, but there's no mention of evening and morning after that. So, is that...
God does not rest every seventh day.
Right.
He ceased the work of creation, but not work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm a former Adventist. So.
Yeah. But a good question is how also Hebrews is pulling on this idea of rest. And what does Hebrews, the author of Hebrews, no idea who that is, how does the author of Hebrews pull on this idea of rest? We've entered into the rest. Christ is the rest. What exactly does that mean? Very good question. But you're right. No evening and morning mentioned for a seventh day. Yeah. Yeah. In the back.
Genesis 1:14, where he talks about the season.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about Hebrew, but
yeah.
A point in time.
Yeah.
So that's different from what we think of the four seasons.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Now it depends. So you're exactly right. The Hebrew word there for, go ahead. Were you finishing your thought? So Moadim is the word in Hebrew that's used there. It's in the plural. Moad is just means something that is appointed, right? So there's a lot of different ways to translate it. And this is the issue when we come to translation. This is some of the problem, because when I translate one word one way, it has all kinds of connections and ideas for us in English that maybe didn't exist in the Hebrew. So whenever we're translating something, we're trying to get as close as we can to whatever connections are in English that we make with the same word that would be in Hebrew. And it's never one for one. It's never one for one, which is why the translation is always a difficult task. It's an incredibly difficult task to undertake. But Mo'ad is just, it's an appointed time. It's something which is appointed. So it's translated here, LSB translated as seasons, but you could translate it as just appointed times. It's kind of in the more of a similar sense of signs, right? They're four appointed times.
Calendar is calendar.
For calendar, yeah. Yeah, right. The idea of being more calendar. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
End of Genesis 2, mother and father. There's no mother and father.
Yeah, there's no mother and father. End of Genesis 2. And we'll, in particular, we'll talk about...
us later on.
Yeah, we'll talk about it in the next portion. Because when you have the fall, after the fall, God says that I will increase your pain in childbearing, but I will increase your conception as well. So they're not mother and father yet. Right? There's not mother and father yet. So it's not completed. It's not, or the process hasn't taken its full effect yet. Right? And Cain is not conceived before the fall. I mean, and we'll, even when we get to chapter 5, we'll see that it seems as though people were having their first child when they were about 80, 90, 100 years old. So they're living for, you know, almost 1,000 years. As it listed out in chapter 5, it's saying this person begets this person when he's 95. This person when he's 105. So it seems as though there's a long period of time. It wasn't those they had, you know, a bunch of bachelors living into their hundreds, just they didn't want to have kids. It's I think there's a difference in how we understand conception before that. We'll look at that next week. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
How can we respond to a professing believer who mm-hmm. says something like, well, Genesis is more poetic and can't be taken literally.
Yeah, and that happens all the time. It happens all the time, and it's happening more and more. You have all kinds of churchgoers, all kinds of professors, all kinds of scholars that will say that exact thing. And they'll say it's more poetic, and so you don't take it at face value. Don't take it literally. And that's just not... it's not what we see in the text. The problem with that kind of hermeneutic, and I pointed this out when we began, is it's all about your hermeneutic when you begin. How do I read the text? In the same way that I read the text about Jesus resurrecting from the dead and therefore giving us hope to resurrect from the dead is the same way that I'm going to read the text about God being the creator. There's poetry. I'll take a look at an example, right? So chapter 2. This one finally is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. That's a poetic statement. But still, is there anything untrue about that statement? Poetry doesn't change the fact. It doesn't change the nature of it. But there are those who would say that the genre is controlling the meaning. And I say, even if it was poetic, which... the text 1 and 2 is not poetic. We have a two verses which are poetic. But even if it was poetic, that still doesn't take away
the literalness of it.
I like to point to those two verses, to verse 23 in particular, and say, well, there's poetry here, but it's not taking away from the literalness of it. So we have to be very careful with any. You can be a believer and hold to that. I just think that you're misguided. I think that you're wrong. And you're headed for a lot more problems. Because if you're taking out the literalness of 1 and 2, you're throwing away a huge amount of your belief. It's a good question. Leo?
So the way you're asking questions, it starts challenging me and giving me like 10 questions just in the first chapter.
You and me both.
Let me ask this first one.
Yeah.
So on chapter 1, verse 3, what it says, and God said, let there be light.
Yeah.
So as a human, we understand what light is.
Yeah.
But then going on chapter 16, it says, and God made the two great lights.
Yeah.
The greater light and then lesser light.
Yeah.
So that means the plan, as he started making that first light, was different than, you know, verse 16 of sun and the moon.
Yeah.
So what is that first light that he...
Yeah.
Mentioned, is that like the master plan, the creation? How do you explain that?
So light, you have light, which is created before sun, moon, and stars, right? And we think of light in terms of sun produces light, right? But also a light bulb produces light. Light itself, I'm not an astrophysicist, I don't even know what those terms mean, but light is something to be created. Light is something which is a substance, an energy, a something. Again, I'm not a scientist in those terms. But it is something which is created. So you can have a created thing before the sun, because the sun is given authority for the light to produce light. But light is not, you had light before the sun. In the same way in Revelation that you have light after. You have light after the sun, or in the eternal state. There's no sun. There's no moon. He is their light. So I would see parallels with that. Yeah.
It's building an idea and a reply to this. For any Christian who does not take Genesis 1 and 2 as a creation, if you go right now to the Big Bang Theory and you take, if you go to Genesis and take God said, it's almost the same chronological order of the Big Bang Theory, mm-hmm. the surge. Mm-hmm. It's first as a surge
yeah.
of light, which is what we know is God, mm-hmm. is the creation process. So not that we're using science to defend the Bible, but it's in keeping.
Yeah.
As we know, the Bible is a nice scientific book, but it's a creation account.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that I want to mm-hmm. when dealing with kids or dealing with other non-believers.
Yeah.
It's in keeping with what God says, whatever we see.
Right.
It's a forensic evidence. The creation is a forensic evidence of God. Isn't
yeah.
what it did. Another question is Ma'adin. Ma'adin is the same word in Arabic, what I grew up talking. It's appointed time, but it's appointed time that covers a place, where and when and what.
Yeah.
Exactly. So if I go to the doctor, that's
yeah.
Ma'adin. So it's the same concept. It's
yeah.
It covers a place, a time, and a what.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Yeah, I would say also... I'm stealing your time, so if you need to leave, feel free to. But when we talk about faith and science, there's been this huge, you know, faith versus science, right? Like, you believe the Bible, so you can't believe in science. I do believe the Bible first and foremost. Again, I'm not taking scientific values and saying I'm going to create my worldview around whatever this scientific value is saying it should be. I'm saying I'm taking the Bible and I'm creating my understanding of reality around that. But I also recognize that the Bible, as speaking truth, will speak correctly about the nature of reality. So whatever the description is that's given, it's not going to reverse what is true. It is the truth. So it's reflecting it correctly. Yeah. Yeah, in the back. Yeah.
Given your understanding, directly, but you know, we just went to the state park, and of course,
yeah.
You know, 15 million years ago,
yeah. Yeah.
It was all underwater, and it's just so factual.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have an understanding now of how you see how old the earth is?
Yes, yeah, 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 I do, I do. And when we get, I think that we can get very, very close to the age of the earth. because of what I see in chapter 5 and chapters 10, the genealogies which were given. And says, this person is this old when they beget this person. So I think that the Bible is giving us a very close period to the creation point. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe future lessons.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be good because it's just so factual.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Speak to how they got so off.
Right.
If they're yeah. just studying science.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Because it's just so factual.
I know it, yeah.
You're stupid.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, exactly. I get that fairly often. Yeah. But chapter 5, we'll speak to that in particular. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Would you mind explaining the creation of the angels
to me? Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, creation of the angels is not mentioned. We have Psalms which say that the creation or the angels were singing during the creation. So it's from the Psalms that we get this idea that there are angels which are present as things are being created, but there's no explanation given as to how much earlier they were created or what that looked like. You have more explanation given about the creation of Satan in Ezekiel. This talks about, you know, the morning star himself. So there's a little bit of explanation given there. But not a great deal that's given. Again, like, I would love to have more chapters like this, and this. So a couple other passages, we piece together some of the chronology, but there's nothing mentioned here.
So there's not, like, a best guess on what day?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Mm-mm. Yeah. Day one with creation, was it before? Was it after? I mean, yeah, it's, I wouldn't wager a guess. Yeah.
But it's possible that it could have been just a day of 24 hours.
Yes.
Earth 24 hours.
Yes.
So it is possible the angels and celestial beings in heaven are created at minute one and then by minute 59.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So we're trying to comprehend something that is beyond our understanding. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because we are bound by the concepts that we have learned.
Yeah.
Physics and chemistry. Time and all that.
Yeah.
And we read into the text, but the text should
be informed. Yeah, right. And also, you see how much is done. Like day two, it just says God separated the waters from the water. That's it. And then on day six, there's like this happened, then this happened, then this, then this, then this, and this. And so it just, yeah, depends. That's good.
Well, in scripture somewhere it says that the humans were created a little bit lower than the angels.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
There you go. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that man. Psalm 8 says that humans were, or mankind was created a little bit lower than the angels, right? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Do we have any understanding of when Adam and Eve's timeline started based on age? Because it says that they died at this age,
right.
But they weren't created as babies.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 And it messes with our mind a little bit. But their day one is day six. So that's their, like, birthday. But they are created already fully mature, right? They're not babies created. So they're created in their prime. I don't know what age the prime is. I'm 37. I like to think that it's 37. But they're created fully developed, yeah.
So I thought it was illuminated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that what we'll return to in Revelation 22:5,
yeah.
Christ is the
life? Right, right. I see a great deal of parallel between Genesis account, the beginning, and the end account, Revelation. There's a huge amount of parallels between that. We're talking about tree of life, but also the light as well, I would see. Yeah, that's good. All right. We're past time. I'll let you guys go. Look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you.